This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Wednesday, January 27th, 2016. I'm Caleb Brown. Crude attempts at genetically engineered foods have been going on for centuries. It's only in the past 30 years that the science has begun to catch up with the desire, and that may create some new problems. Robert Fraley is the Chief Technology Officer at Monsanto. We talked about the ongoing fight over genetically modified foods following a forum on the subject last week. I'd like to start with talking about Norman Borlaug a little bit. What would you say was his chief contribution to science and to global prosperity?
I would just start by saying that I think Norman is Borlaug's contributions were probably one of the greatest humanitarian contributions of all time. You know, for people who don't appreciate it, I mean, as a kid, you know, I can remember watching TV programs when I was 6 or 8 years old about the starvation in India and Pakistan and the dire predictions on you know, starvation and hunger. What Norm did was invented, as a great scientist, invented new wheat and rice varieties that thrived in India and Pakistan. He did all of his research, you know, in Mexico, brought those wheats into India, brought them into Pakistan. They dramatically increased yields. And today, India and Pakistan are our next net exporters of food because of the productivity. You know, the folks who followed it, you know, Norm's, you know, attributed to saving a billion lives. He received the Nobel Prize, really the only person in agriculture who's ever done that. And then he took the financial proceedings from the Nobel Prize and started the World Food Prize, which is now in Des Moines, Iowa. And I had a chance of knowing Norm the last 20 years of his life, and you know, really considered him a mentor. Because he dealt with so much challenge in bringing these new technologies, you know, from across the world to help India and Pakistan. A great mentor, understood practically what it takes to get things done, a great scientist, and a very articulate, you know, spokesperson for agriculture and food security and hunger. And, you know, I had the honor, 3 years ago of winning the World Food Prize. And, you know, for me, it really cemented a long connection to someone who I think is probably one of the most important people that's ever lived.
The hope for GMOs as a category is to continue that work. As you mentioned a couple of times during your talk, doubling of the world food supply is an important goal. Global hunger has been in steady, sustained decline for many years. What are some of the biggest hurdles that you face informationally, regulatory, or otherwise to making the case on behalf of GMOs?
Well, the GMO technology, you know, I had the, you know, way back when, you know, back in the 80s, I had a role in developing the science and inventing the methods, you know, that led to the first GMOs. If you would have asked me back in 1980, 1981, when I joined Monsanto, about what the technology could do and how would it have an impact, frankly, I would have never believed, you know, that here we are today in 2016 and, you know, GMO crops are grown all around the world. They're grown in over 30 countries. You know, they're grown on, 400 plus million acres, which is about 25% of the world's farmland. They've been the fastest adopted, you know, technology in the history of agriculture. On the other hand, you know, 30 years later, they're still, you know, controversial. I think the benefits have been studied and restudied of, you know, helping farmers to improve their yields, reduce their pesticides are really clear. The safety record has been impeccable. I mean, you know, we're celebrating now the 20th anniversary of GMOs, and there's not been a single food or feed safety issue ever associated with them. I'm really proud of that. The technology can make a huge difference. It's not limited by the science. It's really a question of the regulatory policies and the political will and the decision makers The beauty of this technology is we're taking all of these advances in genetic engineering and breeding, but what do we end up with? We end up with a better performing seed. And the importance of that is every farmer in the world, you know, whether you're a large farmer in the U.S. or a small farmer in Africa, knows what to do with the seed. So this is a technology that does not have the huge infrastructural barriers. It doesn't need major, you know, investments in capital or actually even education or training to get much of that benefit. What it needs, though, is a regulatory and political system that enables it.
All right. So on the regulatory side, you discussed the three agencies that you usually typically have dealings with. What are the biggest hurdles that those agencies have put in your path?
Well, you know, I would divide it into two views. One, within the U.S., you know, the way the coordinated framework works is the USDA, EPA, and FDA based on their, you know, expertise and their legal structures, are all involved in regulating parts of the GMOs. The EPA looks at the environmental impacts. USDA looks at transport and plant and agronomy. And FDA looks at food and feed safety. And they all have tremendous expertise. The system has actually really worked incredibly well. And in many cases, it's been modeled around the world, you know, by all the import countries and all the other countries using GMOs. I would say that the U.S. system is still the gold standard. It is largely science-based, and that's really important. The complexity of all the international approvals has made the regulatory process pretty cumbersome. I always use the example. I'm head of research at Monsanto, but if I were the head of research at a drug company, I would develop a new drug, I would get FDA approval, and I would sell it. But because we're developing, you know, corn seeds or soybean seeds that have new GMO traits, I get EPA, FDA, and USDA approval, and then approval from the ministries of health, agriculture, and the environment from 30 or 40 countries around the world. And the good news is it's highly regulated. These products have had a tremendous, you know, impact on farming, but that process is cumbersome. So if I had one wish, it would be great to be able to streamline, you know, those regulatory approvals and use, you know, regulatory approvals that may be pooled between different countries or processes that would make that process more efficient.
Now, for people who are have strongly opposed GMOs, both in the past and currently, I'm thinking of like Nicholas Taleb, who has made almost a cottage industry out of that particular criticism. What do you tell people who are concerned about the what ifs situations regarding GMOs, those with a low probability of occurring but with a high negative consequence?
Well, you know, the bottom line is, you know the first recombinant DNA experiment was done in 1970 out in California. We've been working on crops since the early 80s. They've been in the marketplace for 20 years. They're absolutely the most thoroughly studied, regulated article in the food system. And we have a long history of improving crops, and GMOs have now had a 20-year history of absolutely no health or safety issues, and I think that's remarkable. So it's always easy to raise a lot of what ifs. On the other hand, I think, you know, what we need to achieve is the balance between ensuring public safety, which is always number one, and the enablement of new technologies. And I think in many ways, although, you know, there's certainly improvements we could make in the regulatory process and reducing the international complexity, I think the world's achieved a pretty good balance point between ensuring that the safety of our food system is there and that we're using new innovations and tools that help us meet the continuing challenge of a growing world population. You know, you talked at the beginning of that challenge on food security. You know, 7.3 billion people today, growing to 10 billion by 2050. More people, you know, enjoying increase in personal wealth and ability to purchase and eat better foods and diets. you know, doubling the food supply is going to require us to produce more, waste less, and be more efficient. We will need all of these tools to address what I think is one of the most important challenges facing mankind.
You are director of research. So in terms of the intellectual property that exists within these crops, how problematic is that?
You know, I know it received a lot of attention years ago. I really, in the last 10 years, haven't, I don't think the concerns that a lot of people raise have ever manifested themselves. And let me just point out a couple of points that I think are really important. For a lot of the technologies that are being developed for particularly for smallholder farmers, a classic example is golden rice. You know, here's a technology that can increase the vitamin content of rice and prevent, blindness and deaths in children. That technology was well recognized to have incredible beneficial effect. Every company that had intellectual property, even closely associated with golden rice, donated that technology to the public domain. And there's example after example. We were the first company that that sequenced the rice genome, and we donated that that innovation and intellectual property. On the commercial side, the way the bargain works is you get a patent for a product. You get a certain period of time. It's typically, 15 years where you have some control over that product, and then it becomes part of the public domain. And actually, we are working right now through that exactly happening in the world of agricultural biotech. The first biotech product launched was Roundup Ready soybeans here in the U.S. in 1996, and the patent on Roundup Ready soybeans expired several years ago. And now that product is in the public domain. There are, seed companies and breeders that are developing that product. And I think the system worked. Monsanto had several years where they could collect royalties on that product and get the payback for the investment. And in return, that intellectual property is now part of the public domain to be used, in the future. And that's a great example, I think, of a system that frankly has worked both on the commercial side and on ensuring that that smallholder farmers around the world have access to these tools.
When does the timer begin on those patents? At what point in the regulatory process does that timer begin on those patents?
Well, it used to be in the U.S. The U.S. had a system where it was first to invent. So it was when the patent office declared the discovery made. The U.S. system shifted, so it was first to file. So now the clock actually begins when the patent application is filed with the patent office.
Okay. Do the regulatory hurdles pose any problem there?
The challenge you run into, let's say your the life of your intellectual property is 15 or 20 years, the time it takes us to develop a new product, from the time we would discover a new gene that could be beneficial to help farmers, by the time we do the testing, the development, the regulatory work, that's almost a 13-year process. So that means, the opportunity to capture value for that investment is diminished. And, the pharmaceutical industry faces the same challenge with a new drug. And so there's always a timing issue, and that's an important one. And it really, helps, I think, focus, what you invent and how you bring these new products to the marketplace.
How does that affect the business model of a company like Monsanto, where you have you're working in large part in patents that will go away?
I describe it really simply. I think in many ways it's been a key to our success, because not only have we the challenge of continuing to invent to replace our own products, but our business practice from day one has been to license our inventions to many of the other seed companies around the world. So when we invent a technology like Roundup Ready or the technology to protect crops from insects, we've licensed that technology to hundreds of companies around the world, including, what people would view as our most significant competitors, like a Pioneer or a Syngenta.
And that's because the The timer has begun.
Because the timer has begun. But, you know, as I've reflected on it, I think it was one of the most important decisions we've ever made. Because think about it this way. We're a research organization. Our people are excited. They develop a new product. And then that product is licensed broadly to our competitors in the industry. And what that creates is the dynamic of the next invention. And I think one of the reasons that our company has been so successful in creating new innovations is that we have a culture built on entrepreneurship and built on the realization that we need to continue to make advances. And frankly, those are advances, frankly, in plant breeding with GMOs. We're now working hard on new areas of science like gene editing, like microbes. Data science tools are very important. I mean, it surprises a lot of people when I tell them that when I look at our R&D, about half of our research budget is investments in plant breeding. About a quarter of it is in biotechnology or GMOs, and then about 25% are in brand new platforms like microbes or data science. So, you know, continuing to invent, I think, is the name of the game.
What are the most persistent criticisms that you hear about Monsanto, which, you know, strikes terror in a few hearts over concerns about intellectual property and crops, about the risks of GMOs? What are the things that you hear most often?
Well, you know, I would say, you know, years ago they would have probably struck a little bit of terror in me, just because it's hard to realize there's such a difference between the company that I know, you know, and I'm proud of the fact that I, you know, am part of Monsanto. It's really a privilege to be one of the few companies on the face of the planet who's 100% focused on agriculture. You know, we have 20,000 employees who wake up every morning thinking about how they help farmers bring new technology into the marketplace. So, you know, there's been lots of misinformation and lots of myths about what GMOs are or what they aren't. But the way I kind of process that today, and I talked about it in the conversation this morning, is it just points out to me what a lousy job we've done as a company and as an industry in communicating to the public that allows some of these myths and misperceptions to persist.
All right, well, let me ask a really.
Let me tell you the top ones. You wanted to get into it.
That's
so
right.
Probably the one that still bugs me the most, and we talked about a little bit today, is you'll hear people say these products aren't safe and they're not regulated. The reality, and we spent an hour and a half today talking about these products are regulated extensively in the U.S. around the world, and they have a 20-year proven track record of safety. So that's one of the big ones. The other one I hear a lot, which, you know, when you think about it, I think deeply it doesn't make any sense, is that somehow farmers are addicted to this technology, or that we've foisted on them some technology that they really don't need, and somehow we've captured them. I grew up on a farm. I can remember my dad spending hours going through which seed to buy, what kind of equipment, what kind of nutrients to use. Farmers are small businessmen. You're not going to fool them to buy a seed that doesn't provide a benefit. The reason, you know, farmers have adopted this technology so extensively around the world is it works. It helps them improve their yields. It helps them reduce their costs. And that one just doesn't stand up to logic.
Okay. What of the criticisms that you do hear regularly, which ones do you find most compelling, or ones that, frankly, the answers simply don't exist yet?
You know, we've talked about safety. We've talked about farmers. You know, I think probably the one that is most, you know, has the most important emphasis is we know that when we're developing a new product for helping farmers control bugs or weeds, that there will be a challenge for bugs and weeds to become resistant to that technology, and that's really key. And the way we address that is we continue to do research to develop new and better methods to controlling bugs and weeds. And the reason, you know, you're asking me, why are you so worried about bugs and weeds? Because if you take a look at farming around the world and production of crops, crop yields are damaged significantly by bugs and weeds. A lot of food is lost due to these pests, and so it's very important to develop new tools. And I think it's a natural part of the process. Some people will raise critics, well, if you're going to get resistance to a new technology, why develop it? I think that's pretty short-sighted. I think the right answer is continue to invest, continue to develop new products, and continue to provide benefits to farmers.
Robert Fraley is Chief Technology Officer at Monsanto. You can watch the full forum on GMOs at our website. Subscribe to this podcast at iTunes, Google Play, and with Cato's new iOS app. And follow us on Twitter at Cato Podcast.